So 18 minutes, right?
Yes.
Thank you everyone for coming. While this thing is loading, let me just repeat that today I'll be talking about the environmental health impacts of a community water and sanitation project in rural India in the state of Maharashtra. This is joint work with Rajan Yang and Christine Poulos of RTI, Sumit Patil of Nirman, which is an organization in Mumbai, India, and Ben Arnold and Jack Colford at UC Berkeley. This study was conceived and conducted and for most parts completed while I was at RTI. This is not that long ago. And let's see what I can cram into the next 17 minutes. It's a five-year study, and so it's a tough act to sort of cram that all in. I, on behalf of all the co-authors, I certify that we have no competing interests or relationships to disclose. That said, funding for this work comes from the World Bank, the South Asia Environment and Social Development Group. And of course, nothing would have been possible without the support of the government of Maharashtra in implementing and in at all stages of the study. And we have several reviewers to thank as well. You can hear me clearly back there, right? I'm stepping away from the mic a little bit. So environmental health, it's a topic that often falls through the cracks because it's no sector's business, really. That said, I think the rationale for this is abundantly clear. It's the number one killer of kids is diarrheal disease. That number is astonishing. It's 2 million kids a year. 1 million of those would be in India alone or in South Asia alone. I mean, you can look at that number different ways. It's 5,000 a day. It's 200 or so an hour. Before the session is over, there's 400 deaths. Besides the fact that it's an astonishing number by itself, perhaps what is more astonishing is the fact that it's completely preventable. And community environmental interventions, such as water and sanitation projects, have been widely viewed as a major mechanism to sort of combat diarrheal disease. And this is particularly true from a scalability or sustainability perspective, as we are going to ramp this up to get to all parts of the world where this is a major problem. That said, the scientific basis for whether these participatory community bottom-up projects work is extremely thin, and the anecdotal evidence is not so conclusive. So the main question that we are asking in this paper, or a series of papers really, is do participatory projects deliver water sanitation and health outcomes? So what we have here is a quasi-experimental matched sample of approximately 242 villages. 80 of them are in the project, 160 are controls, and I will spend a slide or two describing how we came up with this sample, partly because that's sort of a core issue here when you have these bottom-up demand-driven projects. How would you construct the counterfactual for what might have happened without it? And then we have four measurements, two in some ways before the intervention in May and August of 2005, and then two after the intervention in May and August of 2007. So in some ways, our analysis and results of this point are early indicators. It takes a long time for environmental health outcomes to play out, and this is certainly not definitive in that sense. Very quickly, the literature has been sort of reviewed and re-reviewed. Some of you may have seen, those who work in this field will have seen this paper by Lorna Futrell, Rachel Kaufman, and others in Lancet Infectious Disease not that long ago. That sort of revisited Esri's whole review of water and sanitation. And we've also contributed to the literature. It's sort of a recent set of reviews that have come out, which basically argue that despite significant advances in sort of understanding how water and sanitation impact health outcomes, major gaps remain in terms of sanitation and source water treatment, in separating out water quality from water quantity, in certainly understanding the sustainability and long-term behavior change. Almost no study sort of comes into, no rigorous studies qualifies as one that delivers results in sustainability, and certainly none on community participation. These are gaps that have been highlighted over and over again. So it's fairly safe to say that the evidence base on water and sanitation impact, certainly in South Asia, is pretty weak. Most of the work is cross-sectional, so you either have no control groups, no baseline, weak power, small samples. And the focuses are on the consequence of diarrhea and treatment, not really on prevention. From about early 90s through the early 2000s, USAID funded a major environmental health project initiative of a consortium of organizations in Washington. And it's fair to say, again, in that case, that they were advocating a package of hardware, that's the pipes and the, you know, the toilets and the taps and software, behavior change, as well as sort of institutional changes. And these recommendations have not been tested with rigorous data. So that's where we step in. There are two features of this design and analysis that I'll highlight. One is the decision of how to form control groups. And the second is the estimation strategy that we apply. There were many aspects of this project that were complicating and challenging in many ways. It's sort of taken away 5 years of my life. That said, in the interest of time, I'm only going to talk about two of these. So the first issue is, how do we identify control groups? If you think about it, the way these projects are implemented, these are like, some of you may be familiar with these social funds. Communities are encouraged to apply for the money, and they can design and implement whatever type of water and sanitation project that they wish to implement. So you might suspect that there is a phenomenal amount of selection bias here. The communities that are volunteering are somehow different in some ways, or they're being targeted by program administrators in some ways. So what we do here is something unique in some ways. Propensity score matching, which is sort of coming into the biostatistical public health discourse, has typically been used in retrospective analysis looking backwards. What we did here was use census data on the communities that had already participated and census data in the whole state to build a model of who participates. So that was build a probability model, a simple logit model. From that model, we could predict the probability that any community is participating. For every participating community, we could find an empirical surrogate, another community that had the same probability of participating, that had the same score. And then that community was carried forward for the 4 years of the for the data collection, or really here it was 2 years because this took a couple of years to sort of put together this data set. So we are matching control groups within and across districts. We have a very large pool to draw from. India's large country, large numbers of villages, so we didn't have problems on that front. And then we check to see that the matched communities are similar in most attributes. So we have 30 characteristics that we match on, and we check to ensure that that balance is maintained. And then that's how the control groups are formed. Basically, we confirm that control groups are similar in very many different ways. And if there is more time, I'll come back to sort of showing how that's the case. When I say that the overall bias is reduced, if you looked at an unmatched village and one of the participating communities, there were large differences in sociodemographics, water condition, sanitation condition. But with the match, the difference is no longer statistically different. Whichever village that was participating in the project was still different was dropped from the analysis, and those were only four. And in general, once we had done our baseline survey and we compared our control groups and matched and the program villages, there was almost no difference across any of the characteristics. So the baseline survey data also confirms that our pre-matching was pretty effective. So this propensity score pre-matching essentially gets rid of bias due to observable characteristics, the 30 variables that we had in census. There's still other things that might be missing, and that's why we have the benefit, luxury of the foresight or something to have had four observations, two before and two after. And we have this classic with and without before and after design, which allows us to sweep out any sort of time invariant fixed effects. So any changes in the participating communities between 2007 and 2005, less the changes that happened in the control communities in that same period, is the impact of the project. It's the additional impact of the project. Another feature of our design is it's a group intervention, but the beneficiaries are at the household level, so it's like a group randomized trial. So what we are reporting here are intention to treat estimates. These sort of capture the population average treatment effects. Finally, we have multiple observations from the same cluster, so we have to fix the standard errors because there's less data than that's available. Basically, that involves inflating the standard errors. And some of the perceptional variables that were already different by the time the baseline survey was conducted, those are carried forward as linear controls in our estimation. So that's a blitzkrieg of four years of design and analysis. Here are sort of the main results. There's lots and lots of columns and bars here. So let me sort of walk you through the first, and then you'll see this repeating across time. The main outcome here is, you can call it diarrhea prevalence or diarrhea incidence. This is measured as in the two weeks prior to the survey, did the child have an episode of diarrhea? So the first two columns are the project villages. Between 2005 and 2007, so first two column bars, diarrhea rates dropped from 11% to 9%. But notice that it also dropped in control villages from 10% to 9%. This is in the dry season. So there, the difference, 2 minus 1, is not statistically different. So that's why I say that the DID is not statistically different. We also look at that in the rainy season, where you might think it's a water quality effect as opposed to a water quantity effect in the dry season. And here you notice that the control villages actually did better than the treatment villages in some ways. So there is no noticeable change in diarrheal impacts, you know, a year after the implementation. Why might that be happening? Well, let's look at some of the precursors of seeing the change in diarrhea. Tap use, so a tap that's connected to your house and you can get the water when you turn it on. Supposedly the most secure way of accessing water. Those impacts are significant, at least in the dry season. There's a 13 percentage point increase, which is, in relative terms, that's much, much larger. Although in the rainy season, we don't see that change. How about toilets, the main sanitation, a pit latrine that the household uses? There is a major improvement here. Sorry, that sort of flashed by. Okay. I'm going in the wrong direction. That's why. So this bumps up by at least about 10% between the baseline and the follow-on compared to the control villages. Okay, so it went up from 16 to 34%. It also went up from 12 to 22%, but in the net, it increased by quite a lot. So taps and toilets are increasing. Diarrhea is not improving. What might be explaining that? If you look at the quantity of water available, yes, that increases in the dry season by 4.5 liters per capita per day. That's one of the, you know, metrics used. But E. coli in household drinking water has not really improved. If anything, it's declined somewhat. Okay, so water quality hasn't improved. And why might some of this be happening? Because in some ways, these community water and sanitation projects didn't emphasize what I'm going to show, a set of key behavioral changes. Hand washing by the child after, before eating and after defecating. That practice did not change at all. I mean, overall, over time, it hardly changed, and certainly the changes were no more than in the control villages. Okay, so these differences are not statistically significant. Likewise, treating the water before drinking, either by boiling or through chemicals or through filtration, that did not change at all over time or in the treatment villages relative to the control villages. And finally, safe handling of the water. So that is, you're using a narrow neck container, you're not dipping your hands, you have some other ladle or something to transfer it over. Those practices, again, did not change. If anything, they changed very slightly in the rainy season. Okay. So we've, beyond these population average effects, we've also looked at some subgroups, some stratified analysis, particularly for poor and socially marginal subgroups, and we see that for those, there are some changes which are more pronounced. So in relative terms, the poor households did better, and in absolute terms, the scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, which are a major socially marginal group in India, did better. So even though the overall gains may not have been substantial, there are some redistribution in some ways going on within these project communities. The other thing we did was to look beyond the intention to treat estimates at households that actually have now access water and sanitation. So they have a private tap and they have a private latrine. And in those cases, we see some health gains. The diarrheal gains are prominent in the rainy season and weak evidence of gains in the dry season. So, I mean, these are triple difference estimators in some ways. And again, that would be a series of graphs that I don't have here in the interest of time. To sum up, in a way, this community demand-driven bottom-up project in Maharashtra, India, has modest but significant impact on the use of toilets and taps, between 5 and 20% in some ways. The behavioral outcomes, however, hand-washing, treating water, etc., do not change. Okay, so this was an underemphasized part of the activity that the government was implementing in these projects. And as a consequence, you see some improvements in water quantity in the dry season, but not really any changes in water quality, which is often sort of the main culprit in the whole diarrheal fecal-oral transmission. As a consequence, we do not pick up any gains in child health as of yet. Yet we see, because households now have a toilet next to their house and a tap right there, significant time savings, benefits and coping costs. So in terms of household welfare, there are certainly gains to the households. What does this mean for policy? Well, the causal chain from implementing a project to seeing the health gains is very long, and things fall apart somewhere in between. And like I said right up front, this is a year and a half after implementation. Maybe the behavioral changes are coming, and we haven't seen early signs of that yet. That said, there are welfare gains. Households are better off in terms of time savings, and there are some redistributional gains with the poorer and the socially marginal groups doing better. And do we know that these gains are sustainable in some ways? So about half of the households are now paying for these services that they're using. So there's early evidence, some evidence that they have a stake in what they're asking for. So with that, I will leave it, and I'll be happy to take questions on this. As I said, it's been a lot of my life for the last 5 years, and I'll be happy to take more questions. Thank you.